I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. State education officials are set to make public on Tuesday the first high school standardized test scores based on the Common Core curriculum standards. In this hour, Interim State Superintendent Dr. Jack Smith talks to us about the tests and the education approach aimed at making students more career ready. Plus, we talk to a reporter from the Baltimore Business Journal about startup IT companies thriving in the region, and to the leader of the Maryland Film Festival about the big centennial celebration for the Parkway Theater. And ahead of the Craft Beer Festival tomorrow in Canton, we'll talk about the art of craft beer with local brewer John Zarevitz on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone, on this lovely Friday. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you're with us. On today's show, we're going to hear about the tech startup scene in Baltimore from Sarah Gantz, a reporter at the Baltimore Business Journal. And we'll hear about the centennial of the Parkway Theater on North Avenue. The centennial, 100 years, from Maryland Film Festival's Jed Dietz. We'll also check in with a local craft brewer about the latest in local artisan beers that will be showcased tomorrow at the Craft Beer Festival in Canton. But first, we welcome to Midday Dr. Jack Smith. He's Maryland's interim superintendent of schools. Next week, the State Education Department will release the first standardized test scores for Maryland high school students based on the Common Core curriculum standards. This is the new PARC test, which stands for Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers. It's part of an attempt to align standardized testing for students nationally as a result of the No Child Left Behind movement. Maryland is one of about a dozen states using the PARC test to measure academic achievement. Dr. Jack Smith, welcome to Midday.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
I'm glad that you're with us. Tell us about the PARC exam. How is it different from standardized tests that students and their families are used to?
Standardized tests have been in place in Maryland since the 1980s, and they've looked at kind of foundational skills. Do you have the math and reading and writing skills needed at a kind of foundational or adequate level? The new assessments are asking students to not just have the foundational skills, but to show that they can apply those to a variety of different types of information and to apply them so that they show conceptual understanding of what it is they're trying to solve.
This may be asking you to summarize too much, but is it possible for you to point out to me what might have been a typical question before and how this new PARC test drills down into it?
Sure, absolutely. For example, the Maryland functional test would have asked a student to read a passage and identify two or three facts from that passage. You might be reading about a car and you would identify this car can drive, you know, go up to 60 miles an hour, it can hold up to 5 passengers, those sorts of things that you can pull straight from the text. Then we move to the Maryland school assessments, and they might have asked you to do the same thing, only to look at across the passage more information and maybe relate a couple of the ideas, but still pulling information in a sort of showing just simple comprehension and recall from that passage about the car. Maybe, you know, how the car was made by two different companies in two different countries. Under these new assessments, what we're asking students to do is not identify anything that they can pull straight from the text. Rather, it will say, you know, go to paragraph 3 and examine what the character or the scientist or the speaker in the paragraph is saying about the surface of the moon. Now go back and look at the choices. What would be the best interpretation in this section of the question of what that speaker said about the surface of the moon without ever once being able to pull a direct fact from that passage? Then you go to part B of the question, and it says, from paragraph 3, you know, highlight and drag down to this text box the information that best supports the answer that you chose in the first part of the question. So it's very much application and critical thinking. And critical thinking means you're asking questions like who, what, where, why, when, how, and how do these things relate to one another?
And you also, in passing, gave us a clue about another difference. You talked about dragging something into a text box. These PARC tests were designed to be given on computer, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And they were given to Maryland students when?
They were given, this past year it was a two-part test, and so they were given in March and then again in late April to mid-May. So they took the test in two parts this past spring.
But you're just getting the results now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And did most students take the test on computer?
In Maryland, it was about 82% of the students took the assessment on a digital device of some sort.
And the others?
The others took it on a paper pencil, and so they would have, rather than dragging it, they would have had to copy the text into a text box on the paper pencil version.
Let me just tell our listeners that we're going to have Dr. Jack Smith, the interim superintendent of schools of Maryland, with us for another 10 or 12 minutes. So if you've got a question or a comment about the PARC tests, this is your time to call 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. What should parents know about the scores that are about to be released?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. The first thing is this is the third or fourth major reset in Maryland's assessment history. So each time Maryland has done this, there's a new baseline. The baseline is lower than the last administration of the previous assessment. Everyone says, oh, no, the scores have fallen. Scores can't fall on a test you've never given before. So we'll start with a new baseline. It will be lower. Another important fact about this test is that it's going to show growth over time. So when you, these sorts of tests, and this is, I call the new generation of assessments, we're finally able to show year-over-year growth. And whether it's the PARC test, the Smarter Balance test, or some other test, from now on, I think parents are going to be able to see from fourth grade to fifth grade what happened in mathematics for my child specifically, instead of just a scale score and the word proficient. And then the third thing is, by the time they get to high school, the schools in Maryland are being asked to determine if students by the end of 11th grade are college ready, which means they can go into a credit-bearing course at the community college or a four-year institution and not need developmental support for that. So all three of those things, this is the first step, but those are big changes in the way that we report information to parents in the coming months and years.
I'm not sure I understand why you'll be more able to show for an individual student what has changed from
growth
year to year.
Sure.
Why more with this test than any other standardized test?
Because in the past, the tests have not been, to use test speak, vertically aligned. And so when, for example, in the MSA, the Maryland School Assessment, between fourth and fifth grade, if you look at those, you can know how your child's doing at the end of fourth grade. But if you look at the fifth grade assessment, they were not equated mathematically, so you could have confidence that if your child was advanced in fourth grade and was proficient in fifth grade, that he or she had dropped. It just wasn't accurate because it wasn't precise enough, it wasn't discrete enough, and it had not been constructed in a way that allowed us to do that, as these tests have been.
You sound very hopeful.
I am hopeful. That's a good word for it. It's all new. This is the first step.
We have a call from Nick in Baltimore who wants to know about, I think, about how the test, the standardized PARC test, relates to teaching. Nick, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Hi. Just want to say that I love how you're doing on Midday now that Dan's gone. I appreciate what you're doing for the show. Anyway,
thank you.
I'm just curious about how they're really teaching for the test, because back when we took the MSAs, they really just taught to get students to pass the test. I'm just kind of curious how teachers are preparing students for the test these days.
Nick, you sound young. Are you a parent or are you a student?
I'm a student. I graduated a couple years ago from high school.
And you felt that with the MSAs that your teachers were teaching to the test?
Yes, ma'am. They would just teach us practice problems that would be taken from the test instead of really kind of teaching more information. It would be just more trying to spit out answers that would be on the test.
And what jurisdiction did you go to school in? I won't make you identify. I won't make you identify your particular school, but what jurisdiction did you go to school in?
Frederick County.
In Frederick County. Jack Smith,
yes.
Interim Superintendent of Schools, tell us what you would say to Nick about how are they teaching to the Park test?
Well, I think Nick makes a good point that under the MSA, we were working to get every, as I said earlier, every student just to a discrete understanding of discrete pieces of information, like how do you multiply fractions? So can you show that? And so we'd have students do lots of practice in multiplication of fractions. Under these new assessments, it starts with the assumption that you can multiply fractions and ask you to multiply them for a purpose and then explain what your purpose was in the multiplication. A good example, and I know this is taking a lot of time, but before, finding the area of a rectangle was finding the area of a rectangle. Nick is exactly right. So we'd give students lots of problems. Now they give them a problem that is an interestingly shaped room with some closets and some cutouts and a bay window. And they say, how do you find the area of this room? And explain that you're, you know, whether you're buying carpet or flooring or whatever you're going to do to find the area of this space, and explain to us how you knew how to find that correct answer and the steps that you used. And so it's a set of assessments, and I think we should always have these sorts of assessments in the future that don't just ask for discrete addition, subtraction, find the noun, find the name of the main character, but rather you've read this, you know that, now how to use the information in a more real-world, thoughtful application that challenges you.
But so to connect this to Nick's question about teaching, it sounds to me, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but to summarize what you just said, you seem to be saying with Park tests, if you're teaching to the test, that just means you're teaching.
Exactly. In fact, I took the 10th grade Park English test this summer as part of the process.
How'd you do?
For setting the standards. Well, actually, I did pretty well, and I'm an English teacher, and I should do well. It's a very rigorous test. But as I looked at it and took it this summer with a panel of people looking at those thresholds, what occurred to me as a teacher is it's just solid, effective teaching of students to work with material so they have the basic skills, the foundational skills, but they also have skills to do something with that information beyond just regurgitate it. I'm with Nick on this. I think it's a big change.
Okay, and Nick, thanks for your call. Let us hear from Kay in Baltimore, who I think is not with Nick on this. Kay, welcome to the show. I'm not hearing Kay.
Thank you. I'm wondering how the superintendent can justify the amount of time spent testing and preparing for the test versus the amount of time lost with the teaching and the learning.
Dr. Smith?
Sure. There is a lot of time, and that varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, state to state, talking about and working on thinking about assessments. And so in some places there's too much testing, some places there's not enough. It depends. And in Maryland, it's very, very uneven. It's very different across the state. But one of the things that we're working to do is reduce the amount of time that there's any sort of interruption to the school day for testing. I mean, when we went to school, and I don't know, I won't put words in your mouth as to how old you are, but when I was in school, I will say, we took lots of tests, but they were an embedded, integrated part of the classroom experience, so no one really thought of them as anything other than part of the learning process. In the last 10 years under No Child Left Behind, or actually since 2002, when it was passed, there's been so much attention to assessment to keep schools out of adequate yearly progress jail. I'm seeing a profound shift in school systems in thinking more about teaching, more about embedding assessment as a routine part of the daily lesson plan and the daily, you know, it might be a quiz, it might be the teacher just getting kids to put their thumbs up. It's all sorts of formative ways and less of formal event-based tests, and I think that's a good move.
Kay, are you a parent?
Yes.
Of a child where? In what jurisdiction?
Baltimore County.
In the county. So I wanted to ask you whether these Park tests were given, Dr. Smith told us, in the spring. What was your experience of the lead up to the test? Did you feel it, from what your child or children were telling you, was it pulling away from regular instruction or was it embedded in regular instruction?
It was separate from regular instruction. It seemed onerous, tedious, and they could hardly wait to get finished with it. It just seemed to go on forever.
Dr. Smith, what...
The test window, I agree with Kay, was very long last spring. One of the things that the states came together and did, and MSDA did and worked hard to do this, as soon as that test was over, is reduce it from two test windows to one to shorten the test. And, you know, as an English teacher, I would tell you that I would find it very difficult in the future as we think about these types of state assessments to figure out a way to teach to it. I mean, if you had a practice test for it, it should just be a typical high-value assessment that you would give to children as opposed to practicing. You're practicing skills and ways of thinking, but you're not teaching to just get an answer so the kid can be proficient. That's a big change, and I think that the caller is correct that it's going to take some time, but I think it's going to shift pretty dramatically this year and next year to a very different sort of thinking about preparing for these sorts of assessments, more about instruction, less about preparation for the assessment.
Kay, I appreciate your call. This is an issue that we will continue to follow here on Midday, and we're almost out of time here, Dr. Smith, but we're talking about the test scores that the school board will hear about on Tuesday are for the high school students. The elementary and middle school scores, I understand, will be discussed in December.
Right.
So, but looking at this group of students, these high school students, how will these Park test results count or toward a student's graduation?
These particular ones, the shift at the state board level and the regulation for these students is that they must participate, that the score will not have any bearing on whether or not they graduate, because we always want to err on the side of students, and I think as we refine these assessments and think about them, that we need to make very sure that everything's solid, that everything's well implemented, that it makes sense, and that we've continued to shift instruction prior to expecting students to get a certain score in order to graduate.
So that's true this first year? Will that continue to be true of the Park test?
That was true last year. It's true this year, and the state board will take up that matter. In fact, they'll be discussing it initially this Tuesday at the state board meeting, and then in the future they'll look at every single piece of information as they consider what that next step should be.
I appreciate you giving us this overview. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll hear from Baltimore Business Journal reporter Sarah Gantz. She's written a cover story published today about Baltimore's booming tech startup scene, so you don't want to miss that. Stay tuned. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, and we welcome to our studio Sarah Gantz, who covers healthcare, higher education, biotech, and technology for the Baltimore Business Journal. Today, she's written a cover story about the booming tech startup business in Baltimore. Sarah, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
Sure. I'm glad you're here. Tell us, let's start with the breaking news. AOL Incorporated announced just this morning that it finalized its acquisition of Millennial Media, the Baltimore-based mobile advertising firm. The deal was first announced last month. Tell us more about the deal.
Sure. So as you said, it was first announced last month, September. AOL has been growing a lot. They themselves were recently acquired by Verizon. They saw Millennial as a way to do something that they don't already have, which is mobile advertising. Millennial has a big background in mobile advertising. It's an area that a lot of other companies, Google, Apple, Facebook, all these big companies want to get into, and AOL had this decision to make. Do we build this out ourselves, or do we acquire a company that already knows how to do it? So that's why they're acquiring Millennial. It's a deal that will mean that Millennial gets to keep doing what it does. It's still undetermined what will happen with Millennial Space. We've heard tentatively that they'll still be here in Baltimore. AOL has said that they want to commit to the Baltimore area. They years ago acquired a different Baltimore startup, advertising.com. You might remember them.
Mm-hmm.
So AOL already has presence here. Advertising.com is still based in Baltimore. But under this deal, Millennial Media, which has been a publicly traded company since, I believe, 2012, now is a wholly owned subsidiary of AOL.
And we don't know whether it's staying or...
We believe it's staying. You know, those are all details that
and
obviously
we believe
are...
its executives are staying.
Not all of its executives are staying, no. Some executives got what is called a golden parachute deal. So it's a deal that is decided upon in advance. It's a way for them to get a certain amount of compensation, and their employment terminates when the deal closes. So CEO Michael Barrett is among the executives who's leaving. I think there are 9 executives that AOL does want to keep on, including the COO and the, I believe it was the president of Platform that they're keeping on. But there are several that are leaving.
Speaking of money, this you just reported this deal is a $250 million in equity and net debt. What kind of stock price are they paying?
They paid $1.75 per share for outstanding Millennial stock.
Which is above where it was trading, I presume?
It was around where it was trading, depending on the day. There has been some pushback from investors, or more likely stockholders, not investors, but stockholders who feel that that number undervalues the company. There's even a class action lawsuit out there saying that while, yes, that's around what it had been trading at most recently, the value of Millennial is more... Back when Millennial went public, I think they went public at $13 a share, and they were trading much higher. Lately, it's been lower. So there's some debate out there about whether this is a good enough deal.
So does this news story about AOL's acquisition of Millennial, does that tie in with your cover story about the boom in tech startups in Baltimore?
It does. The story I wrote today focuses on just a lot of momentum we've been seeing over the last months and year in Baltimore when it comes to technology and startups. So startups aren't necessarily tech companies, but
right.
People who have interesting ideas, who are entrepreneurs that want to start businesses. By momentum, part of that is big deals like this, big name companies like AOL saying, you know, there's a company in Baltimore that we want to buy. And, you know, another one that comes to mind is Groupon acquiring OrderUp over the summer. That's a piece of the puzzle. Big acquisitions like that shine a lot of attention on Baltimore, not only because of the headlines, but also because, you know, it makes other investors think, well, what else is going on in Baltimore? Is there something else going on in that city? Is there another company there that I should be keeping my eye on?
Well, and you begin this piece with a vignette of Steve Case, AOL's founder, touring Startup and other places. I'm sorry, OrderUp and other spots in Baltimore. Case is a tech investor. His investment arm is called Revolution LLC.
Right.
Tell us about that tour. I mean, it seems to have been something you thought was a summary of what's going on.
Sure, yeah. Steve Case is obviously a big name in technology. His venture firm, Revolution, was one of the lead investors in OrderUp, the food ordering delivery company that Groupon acquired over the summer. Case has this own personal venture tour that he does. It's called Rise of the Rest. It's a bus tour. And by
Rise of the Rest.
Yes. And by that, he means rising up the rest of the cities that are interesting places for startups, aside from the really big names you hear about all the time, like Silicon Valley, New York, and Boston. Where are the rest? And Baltimore is a place that he sees as one of the rest, a place that is a good place for entrepreneurship. And to me, Steve Case's visit to Baltimore just really highlighted the fact that this city is getting more attention. Steve Case investing in companies here, coming here and starting his venture tour kickoff in the city by going and visiting with other entrepreneurs here, it just adds to that buzz.
And describe the scene further. First of all, you're talking about Baltimore as a region, right? Not just the city.
Not just the city, the region.
And how have you traced this? How much is it How much bigger is it than, say, 5 years ago? How many jobs are involved? How many companies involved?
You know, I don't have specifics on the number of jobs and the number of companies, but if you just look at what's going on out there, there are so many more physical places for startups to go these days. Hopkins has invested big in startups over the last few years. You know, they used to not have a real place, an incubator, for companies to go, and they started Fast Forward out of their engineering school, and it's grown so much just over the last couple of years. They now have two locations.
Fast Forward is the name of the incubator.
Yes, they work with lots of companies, and it's a way for Hopkins to, you know, one of the problems that they have had with turning their research into startup companies is, well, people have these good ideas, they develop it into a patent or a license, and then they go somewhere else with it. They leave Baltimore. Having spaces like this is a way for them to keep that talent here and to grow those companies locally. So I see just the physical presence of companies and the physical places that they can set up shop as a big indicator of the fact that this is a field that's growing. Betamore has come online recently.
Betamore is also an incubator?
Betamore is not a formal incubator. They host startup companies. They've transformed themselves over the last year to be really what they call an innovation hub, I guess. They have a co-working space for companies. They have a lot of membership, and, you know, networking and education type resources. So they're not just an incubator, but they do host small companies.
I was struck as I read what you wrote about Johns Hopkins' role as an incubator and an investor in startups that I didn't see University of Maryland mentioned. And a year or two ago, when there was a discussion about perhaps merging University of Maryland College Park and Maryland campuses of the university system. Part of what when they decided not to merge, but they're going to do all these startups, they're going to have all this cross fertilization. I'm getting the impression it didn't rise to the level. It doesn't. The activity that you, as a reporter, picked up on was not being generated by the University of Maryland.
You know, University of Maryland does invest in startups, and they have a lot going on over at UM Biopark. They have a lot of pharmaceutical and bio companies. One of their companies now is working on a potential HIV vaccine with some of the University of Maryland researchers. But what stood out to me was a distinct shift in what Hopkins is doing to Hopkins being one of the universities that brings in the most in federal research funding and having such a stark contrast between them and their peers at Stanford and Harvard, just in the amount of research that they turn into companies. Hopkins has really picked up its game in recent years, in my opinion, just in the amount that they're putting toward it. Whereas Maryland, I would say that they have been investing in this all along. Hopkins, too, has been investing, but I see a noticeable change.
Hmm. That's Sarah Gantz, reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal. She covers healthcare and what are some of your other beats, Sarah?
It's mostly healthcare and technology these days.
And technology is obviously keeping you busy. Has this boom that you're describing, or incipient boom, the tech scene is starting to go pop, is the headline. Has this been steady? And did the events of this spring in Baltimore, what some call the uprising, has it had any impact on the tech startups?
You know, I don't know how much of an impact that has had broadly, but I will point out one place that has seen that as extra momentum for what they're doing. Another new place for startups to go, Impact Hub. It's going to be up in Station North coming soon. They see themselves as a community for companies that have a do-gooder mentality, startups that want to in some way give back to the community, help address some of these deep-seated problems that we're seeing in Baltimore. And I know I spoke with the organizers a few months ago, and they said that everything that happened in Baltimore was just evidence that we really need that type of resource for companies. So I would say that while I haven't seen a lot of evidence that it is negatively hurting the startups, I've heard from several companies that want to move to Baltimore to be part of the tech community here. It does seem that it's maybe giving fuel to the fire for companies that have felt all along that that needs to be a central part of their mission, giving back to the community.
Hmm. Another story that the Baltimore Business Journal reported on this week relates to the uprising, and that is that the Rite Aid on North Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard at 300 MLK Jr. Boulevard. The Rite Aid that was damaged in the riot has reopened.
Yes, it has. That was one of, I believe, 8 Rite Aids that were burned and looted during the riots, and, you know, at least a dozen total pharmacies, including some CVS locations. That Rite Aid is the last to reopen. There are 7 other Rite Aids that have reopened. This one they had to totally demolish and rebuild. Having pharmacies in the community is really important, especially in areas that are underserved as far as grocery stores and other retailers, because it's a place for patients to get prescriptions, to get basic needs met, you know, as far as food and pharmacy items. So having the store reopen is huge for the community. They've been operating out of a trailer since it was burned.
So Rite Aid is now back to its strength from before April?
In presence, yes. All of their stores have reopened. This was the most damaged and the last to reopen. I believe the CVS up on North Ave, which kind of became a symbol.
Pennsylvania, North Ave.
Yes. I don't believe that one has reopened. I don't know where they are with it, but they've committed to reopening that as well. I know I reported shortly after the riots what an important staple that was for the community. It's an area that's sort of in, you know, what they call a food desert. Lack of grocery stores, and that played a big role in getting prescriptions to an elderly community in the area, basic food supplies.
There was another story in the Baltimore Business Journal this week about the space between Federal Hill and the Inner Harbor with a great headline: "The big question for Rash Field architects, who is it for?" What does that story tell us?
Well, it tells us that we are still to come with details about what will happen with Rash Field. I think it's a really exciting project because it's green space in an area that's in the access to the downtown area. It's somewhere certainly that families could go. People could, you know, take a break during lunch or in the middle of the day or their work day. And it sounds as if we're still in the process of figuring out what exactly will go there. There have been some details, but I think that the architects that were selected really want to get feedback from the community. Our reporter, Sarah Meehan, reported on that, and what she was told is that they want to talk to everyone in the community, make sure they get feedback from everyone so that they, when they do move forward with that project, that it's something that will truly address the needs and wants of everyone who will be using it.
It's something for us to all watch then. Sarah Gantz, thank you so much for giving us these heads up.
Thank you.
Sarah Gantz is a reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal. We're going to take another quick break, and when we return, we shift gears a bit and hear about movies and beer, the 100th anniversary of the Parkway Theater, and this weekend's Craft Beer Festival in Canton. So that's a reason to stay with us. I'm Sheila Cass. Don't go away. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast, and I've got some great guests with me right now. The Parkway Theater in Station North is celebrating its 100th birthday. Jed Dietz, director of the Maryland Film Festival, is here to tell us about the Parkway's history and what's in store for its future. Welcome back to Midday, Jed.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
So tell us about the opening of the Parkway Theater back in 1915.
Yeah, so it opened on exactly this day, 100 years ago.
This is the birthday.
This is exactly the birthday. And it opened with a film called Zaza, starring Pauline Frederick. Since long gone, the film's actually been remade a couple of times, but the one the Parkway opened with has disappeared.
And this would have been a silent film, right?
Oh, yes. It was silent for the first 12, 13 years of its existence. It was a movie theater. It was opened as a movie theater. Very unusual in that time to not build something that also had vaudeville or some other things. This was a pure movie theater, and it was a movie theater through 1978 under various ownerships.
Was there a big hoopla when it opened?
Oh, it was huge. It was written up in the National Press.
Why in the National Press?
Well, because it was a big gamble for this developer. Henry Webb was the developer, and to build a movie house, I mean, this was the beginning of feature film as we now know it. I mean, this was the year Birth of a Nation came out, so which is the first big commercial feature film. Movies had been around, but they'd been, you know, little storefront things where you'd walk in, you'd put a nickel in a machine and watch a 3 or 5 minute film of a train arriving at a train station. And this was really the beginning of storytelling in movies as we now know it. You know, 15 years later, 65% of Americans were going to a movie every week. So it exploded from this point forward. And there are very few of these movie theaters left. I mean, there are, you know, you look through the historic sites and stuff like that, and you'll see movies that opened in the late 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. Some of those movie theaters have been converted into shoe stores and all sorts of sad things, or destroyed completely. So to have this jewel available to us now is, I mean, there aren't many of these in all of America. So
this was, I read that this was modeled on London's West End Theater?
It was. The developer sent his architect, who's a guy named Oliver White, who designed several houses and various things in Baltimore, to London to look at the West End, which had just opened, and then up to New York to see a Thomas Lamb theater called The Strand, which had opened the year before. Mm-hmm. But that was vaudeville and movie, but had a scale. The Thomas Lamb buildings all over were scaled in a very elegant way. And this was in a wealthy neighborhood. The developer's assumption was this was an art form for rich people only. It'd be very elite art form. He had a tea room in this theater. Fresh flowers were brought in, staff of 40.
A staff of 40?
Yeah. And
what all did they do besides water the flowers?
Well, they were ushers. They were manning the tea room, I guess. I mean, it was there were musicians. There was an organ that accompanied the movies. And sometimes more musicians were brought in. So there was a certain kind of maintenance thing. And the idea that it
When did you... We're having a discussion about Jed's cell phone. Why don't you just put it on your lap? We're nervous about it being on the table.
Okay. And so it went from, you know, that presumption, and then he started adjusting, because it was very clear from that point forward very quickly that all sorts of people wanted to go to movies. And that's, of course, where we are to this day. I mean, it's the biggest cultural art form by a long shot.
Okay, that's where we are to this day in terms of social experience, but apparently at some point it stopped working for the Parkway Theater because it's been decades since it's been a theater. Right?
Yes, it worked through 1978, and then it's closed as a movie theater, and various attempts at developing things there were made, but the whole neighborhood had sort of run down, and now it's coming back up, and one of the components I think that we can add to it are this film center that will have 3 screens and about 600 seats total, and will now bring movies that don't now come to Baltimore. There were 950 films reviewed in the New York Times last year. These are just commercial open films. It doesn't include MoMA or Lincoln Center or any of that film showing. And about 300 come to Baltimore. You know, the Charles and the Senator and the Landmark serve a great purpose here. But there's more out there, and we want to bring them to town.
So what is the film festival's role now with Parkway Theater, and who are your partners? I mean, what is this going to be? You said three screens.
Yep, so it'll be 3 screens and 600 seats total. So it's much smaller than the Landmark or the Charles or the Senator, the mm-hmm. Rehabilitated Senator. And we are partnering with Hopkins and MICA to get this whole thing off the ground because they've expanded their film departments and moved them into the center building at 10 East North across the street. They've already opened. They started this year. And their students and faculty will use the screens during the day for projects and stuff like that. We see this as a real center for emerging filmmakers. And we'll be bringing in filmmakers from all over the country to host screenings and interact with the students. And not just Mike and Hopkins students. It'll be a real community place, too. But certainly those departments are key members of this coalition.
So, and what is the timeline for making that happen?
Well, so after we launch tonight at the birthday, we'll celebrate its 100 years and then launch the public phase of our campaign. We'll start construction in November. We've raised a bunch of money, so we'll start in November, and we'll open the building as a film center, the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Parkway Film Center, in the first quarter of 2017.
So yep. Less than 2 years from now,
yes.
A year and a half or so, you expect to do this. Yep. And you said this birthday celebration today. Well, describe the birthday celebration.
So it starts at 8 o'clock. It's going to be
tonight.
Yes, and it's going to be in the neighborhood. So it's going to center on the Why Not lot, which is right across the street from the parkway on the corner of Charles and North. The building will be lit in a special way, so you will be celebrating the building. There's going to be music, food, drink. It's going to really be a great party, I think, starting at 8 o'clock.
And it is a fundraiser.
It's not a fundraiser.
It's a party.
It's all free.
But you said it launches the – you said – I forget the exact phrase, but launches the public part of our campaign. There is
– that
– there. The campaign is
– so the campaign will be to complete our goal between now and the opening of the building. And everybody, I mean, there will be lots of information about that, but we're not doing any fundraising tonight.
This is a celebration.
Yeah.
That's great. And where can people get more information?
You can go to the website's just being launched now. It's parkwaycampaign.org, or you could go through the Maryland Film Festival website and get more information. You'll get there too. There's a wonderful little 3-minute film that's got some of the local filmmakers in it to talk about the building, and you get to see some of the insides of the building, too.
Cool. And that's at www.parkwaycampaign.org.
Correct. Right.
Wonderful. Jed, I appreciate your telling us about it. And when Jed said the word drink a minute ago, when he talked about there'll be food and drink tonight, he turned to his colleague here, or his fellow guest here in our studio, and that is John Zarevitz, and that's because the Craft Beer Festival gets underway tomorrow in Canton. It's a celebration of microbrewing, which has experienced big growth and popularity in Baltimore and across the state in the past 5 years. John Zarevitz, you're co-founder of Union Craft Brewing, an expanding microbrewery that's in Woodbury near Hampton. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about Union Craft Brews.
Well, the brewery was started about 3.5 years ago by myself and my two partners, Adam Benish and Kevin Blodger. We sort of lean towards some sessionable and often German styles of beer.
I'm sorry, sessionable?
Sessionable. So there's a term in beer that you called session beer, which is basically sort of lower alcohol, lower ABV beers, so you can have more than one in a session.
That's what makes it sessionable.
Yes. So for a long time, craft beer was trending towards higher alcohol, and that was sort of its departure point from, you know, your regular macro brewed beers. But now we're seeing craft embracing lower ABV beers, which really invite more of a wider audience to come and enjoy them and expand their palates and appreciate.
Yeah. Some of your brews have great names.
Thank you. Tell us
some.
Well, our flagship pale ale is called Duckpin, so we're celebrating that quirky little sport that we invented here in Baltimore. We have our Balt Alt beer, which is a play on Baltimore and the alt beer style. We have Blackwing Lager, which is a little tribute to the Orioles and the Ravens. And we have our Anthem Golden Ale, which we released for the bicentennial celebration of the writing of the National Anthem at Fort McHenry.
So how do you come up with these names? I mean, do you sit around and brainstorm them, or do they just occur to you in the midst of some brewing duty?
It's a creative brainstorm session. We're always looking to draw on Baltimore culture, as sort of the first concepts. We try to have them also appeal to the beer style that we're creating. So it could either be the name. Sometimes the names are just in a list that I have, saved on my computer, and then eventually a beer style comes around that we're going to brew that fits that. Or we know we're going to brew a certain style, and then I use that as the conceptual departure point to come up with the name.
So the festival, is there a competition element to it, or is it just people getting together and having access to great beers?
Well, there is a homebrew competition, which is new to the festival this year. So that's when, we invite the local homebrewers to submit beers, and then they're judged, by a panel of brewery owners and head brewers. I'm actually on the judging panel this year. But there is a competition that sort of occurs before the festival. It's called the Comptroller's Cup, and all the Maryland breweries enter into that, and they will make the awards announcements, you know, at the festival.
So, I mean, does that mean that you're competing with, like, imported beers and...
No, just with Maryland breweries.
With Maryland breweries.
Correct.
On October 1st, I'm told Union Craft announced it would begin distribution to select Virginia counties through a partnership with Virginia Eagle Distributing Company. So your beers, like Duckpin Pale Ale and Bald Alt, are available in Arlington, Fairfax, and Loudoun counties.
That's correct.
In Virginia. Talk about the expansion.
So our beer had been distributed widely across Maryland and as well as D.C., and we saw Northern Virginia as a natural extension of the D.C. market, and we had been looking to expand a little bit as the brewery grows and our capacity grows, and we are secure in being able to supply the Maryland and D.C. markets. We wanted to reach out to Northern Virginia, so just those, you know, up northernmost counties. A lot of people there who live in Northern Virginia but work in D.C., so they can acquire our beers, you know, when they're at work or on the D.C. side, but can't get them when they're at home. So it's just a natural extension of our market. But we're really excited to bring the beer down there. We still feel very local to Northern Virginia, so it's a nice fit for us.
Is it complicating distributing across state lines?
It certainly gets more complicated as you enter new markets. So in each market, you have to partner with a new distributor. The beer is obviously going further away from home, so it's harder to control and know what's going on down there. We have to obviously spend a lot more time away from home and get people on the street. So you got to hire a sales rep in that territory to keep tabs on things. And distributor brewery relationships are often complicated in and of themselves. So the more distributors you have, just the more complicated that part of the business gets.
And when you say it's harder to control, does beer travel well, or does the beer itself just not? Is there a risk it won't taste as good in Loudoun County as it tastes in Baltimore County?
You know, it should arrive safe and sound and in very high quality. But as the beer moves further away, you know, it's just harder to know how long has that beer been sitting on the shelf. Like in my local market, you know, I can go and check on things, or our sales rep can go and check on things and be able to rotate stock and rotate product, make sure it's the freshest that is available. But, you know, as the beer travels further from the brewery, it's exposed to more things that we don't necessarily know about. It can be temperature sensitive. You want to keep this beer, you know, refrigerated as long as possible. You know, it's just a quality control issue.
Real quickly, we have just a minute or so left, but you mentioned a homebrew competition. Is beer now being brewed even smaller than microbrewery?
Yeah, the home brewing community has grown tremendously, especially in this area. A lot of people are just getting some homebrew kits, and high quality ingredients are now readily available for the homebrew shops. And there's lots of organizations and clubs to join, and you know, go and brew with your friends in your basements. That's how many of us started. You know, just doing it on a turkey fryer or on the stovetop.
We'll have to have you back, and you have to tell me how to make beer in
sure.
a turkey fryer. But you have a great time this weekend. It sounds like it's going to be a fun festival.
Thank you. It really is going to be great. It's the largest assemblage of Maryland craft beer ever. So it's really going to be
a great
celebration. I believe there's a VIP hour from noon to 2 if you got a VIP ticket, and then from 2 to 6 is the general admission.
Tomorrow in Canton.
Correct.
John Zerovitz, thank you. He's the founder of Union Craft Brewing in Woodbury. And I also want to thank Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival. Happy birthday to the Parkway Theater.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Joe Squared. Lunch for today's guest is provided by Joe Squared Pizza, which serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers. For locations and hours, visit joesquared.com. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you've been with us this week. I hope you have a great weekend. There's terrific weather, fabulous colors in the trees I noticed in the sunshine this morning. Get out and do something that gets your heart pumping. I'm Sheila Cast. Come back with us on Monday.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.